All right, let's dive in, shall we? Today we're tackling a real head-scratcher of a case, Lambert v. Blackwell. It throws us right into the deep end of federal habeas corpus, and trust me, the waters get murky fast. We're dealing with murder, claims of prosecutorial misconduct, and a whole lot of legal back and forth.
You know, it's one of those cases that really exposes the fault lines in our justice system. The tension between state and federal courts is always there, simmering beneath the surface, but this case brings it right out in the open.
So paint the picture for us. We've got Lisa Michelle Lambert convicted of murder back in 92. Years pass, and suddenly she's claiming prosecutorial misconduct talk about throwing a wrench in the works. Perjured testimony, suppressed evidence, you name it, she's alleging it. And here's the kicker. A district court actually declares her actually innocent after a two-week hearing. You'd think that's game over, right?
You'd think so, wouldn't you? But then, out of left field, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals steps in and reverses that decision. It sent shockwaves through the legal world, let me tell you.
Okay, so what happened? What could possibly derail such a seemingly clear-cut win?
Well, it all hinges on this concept called exhaustion. It's a fundamental principle of federal habeas procedure, and basically it means that before you can even knock on the federal court's door, you have to have exhausted all your options within the state court system. Think of it as checking all the boxes before you can level up, so to speak.
So even if a federal court thinks, hey, this person might actually be innocent, they can't just step in unless and until the state courts have had their say. That seems a little, well, backwards, doesn't it?
I can see why you'd say that. It's a tricky balance, isn't it? On the one hand, you want to make sure that potentially innocent people aren't trapped in legal limbo. But on the other, you don't want federal courts second-guessing state courts every time there's a disagreement. It's about respecting that division of power, you know?
So, back to Lambert. The Third Circuit essentially tells her, go back to the Pennsylvania courts, see if you can get relief there. Did she get a fair shot in the state system, or was it an uphill battle from the start?
Oh, she definitely went back through the Pennsylvania courts, multiple times, in fact, but ultimately they upheld her conviction. And that's where we run smack into another big legal hurdle, AEDPA deference. It's a real game changer when it comes to federal courts overturning state court decisions.
AEDPA deference.
Yeah.
That sounds intimidating. Break it down for us. What's the bottom line?
Essentially, AEDPA, it stands for the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, made it a whole lot harder for federal courts to overturn state court decisions. Think of it as raising the bar, like significantly. Federal courts basically have to show a ton of deference to state court rulings and can't just retry the whole case as if it were starting from scratch.
So even if Lambert had gone through every single avenue in the Pennsylvania courts, dotting her I's and crossing her T's, she still faced an uphill battle in federal court because of AEDPA.
You got it. It's not about micromanaging every state case. They're looking for clear-cut constitutional violations, not just, you know, disagreements over how the facts were interpreted or evidence was weighed.
Let me see if I'm following this. First, you've got the exhaustion requirement, meaning that the state courts get the first crack at it. And then, even if you make it to federal court, you've got AEDPA deference staring you down, setting a super high bar for overturning a state court's judgment. It sounds like the deck is kind of stacked against anyone trying to appeal a state conviction.
It's definitely a tough road, that's for sure. And Lambert v. Blackwell is a textbook example of just how tough it can get.
But here's what gets me. We're not just talking about some minor procedural slip-up. Lambert's team was alleging some pretty serious stuff. They were saying the prosecution flat out lied, hid evidence, the whole nine yards. Did the courts even really address those claims, or was it all about procedure?
Yeah, that's what's so troubling to me. It's not just a matter of, oh, they missed a deadline or filed the wrong form. We're talking about potentially game-changing allegations here. Like, let's start with the perjury claim. Didn't Lambert's team dig up evidence that seemed to directly contradict what a key witness said on the stand? Oh, absolutely. They found this witness questionnaire that seemed to totally clash with the witness's testimony at trial. And Lambert's argument was, well, this shows the prosecution knew, or should have known, this witness was giving false testimony. That's a huge deal, potentially a major Brady violation, right?
Right, because Brady requires the prosecution to disclose any evidence that could help the defense, especially if it could cast doubt on a witness's credibility. So what did the Third Circuit do with that? Did they side with Lambert on the perjury issue?
Not exactly. They acknowledged the inconsistency, but ultimately they deferred to the state court's finding that the questionnaire was, quote, inconclusive. And remember, under AEDPA, they can't just substitute their judgment for the state court's. They have to show the state court's conclusion was, like, objectively unreasonable. It's a really high bar to clear.
So even if there were some red flags waving in the wind about this witness's testimony, it wasn't enough to prove the prosecution intentionally presented false testimony.
It's tough, right? Proving intent is always tricky. And it kind of speaks to this bigger debate about the limits of AEDPA. Some legal scholars are like, hang on, this level of deference could actually be shielding unconstitutional convictions from meaningful review.
So even if there's this gut feeling that something's not right, if the state courts follow the rules, at least on paper, federal courts are pretty much hands off.
It definitely seems that way. And that's where these calls for AEDPA reform come into play. It's like, okay, we want to respect state court authority, but what about when things go wrong? What about when the system, you know, messes up?
It's a tough question, no doubt. Now, what about the suppressed evidence claim? Lambert's team also said the prosecution withheld information that could have helped her defense. What happened with that?
So this is where Brady really takes center stage, as you mentioned. Brady says, you know, the prosecution has to turn over anything that's favorable to the defense and material to the case. And Lambert argued the prosecution didn't do that and that it could have changed the outcome of the whole trial.
Okay, so did the Third Circuit buy that argument?
Well, again, they deferred to the state court's findings. Basically, they said, even if there was a Brady violation and they weren't definitively saying there was one, it wouldn't have changed the trial's outcome anyway. They kept emphasizing, look, federal habeas review isn't about second-guessing every single little evidentiary ruling. It's about making sure the trial was fundamentally fair, constitutionally speaking.
So it's like they're saying, even if the prosecution dropped the ball, the evidence against Lambert was already so strong, it wouldn't have mattered in the end.
That's one way to put it. It really underscores how narrow the scope of habeas relief is. You know, it's not some magic wand that can just erase a conviction.
It all feels so incredibly procedural. It's like, are we really focused on whether Lambert might actually be innocent, or are we just worried about whether the state courts follow the rules, you know, dotting their I's and crossing their T's?
That's the tension at the heart of so many legal debates, right? Procedural rigor versus potential injustice. And in Lambert v. Blackwell, the Third Circuit seemed to really prioritize that procedural side of things. They were like, look, we have to respect the integrity of the process, the authority of the state courts.
So even if there's this nagging feeling that justice wasn't served, if the state courts technically did everything by the book, federal courts are hesitant to intervene.
That's what it boils down to. And that's why this case is such a lightning rod, you know? It forces us to ask these really uncomfortable questions about our justice system, like what happens when things go wrong? What happens when someone is potentially innocent, but the system, you know, for whatever reason, fails them?
That's the question that keeps coming back to me. You know, like what happens when the system, the very system that's supposed to protect us, what happens when it makes a mistake? If AEDPA deference is all about preventing federal overreach, is it also possible that it's shielding these flawed state convictions from getting a second look?
It's the elephant in the room, isn't it? And it's a huge part of the debate around AEDPA reform. Critics are saying, sure, we don't want federal courts becoming like super reviewers for every state case, but has the pendulum swung too far in the other direction? Are we actually letting legitimate claims of injustice slip through the cracks?
So how do we even begin to balance those two things? Respecting state court authority, but also making sure individuals get a fair shake. It feels like, I don't know, trying to walk a tightrope or something.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And that's why you're seeing all these calls for AEDPA reform gaining momentum. There are a bunch of different proposals out there, but they all boil down to trying to fine-tune that balance between state and federal power.
What are some of the ideas people are tossing around? What would these reforms actually look like?
Well, one of the big ones is narrowing the scope of deference. It's like, okay, let's give federal courts a little more breathing room to actually review state court decisions, especially in cases where there's pretty strong evidence of a major screw-up or misconduct. It wouldn't be a complete overhaul, but more like a recalibration to make sure that genuine claims aren't getting brushed aside too quickly.
So basically give federal judges a little more wiggle room
yeah.
to step in when it seems like, yeah, something went wrong here.
Exactly. Another idea is beefing up the standards for proving ineffective assistance of counsel. You know, Lambert argued her trial lawyer didn't do a good enough job. But under the current system, winning a claim like that is next to impossible. It's incredibly tough.
So the thinking is that if we make it a bit easier to prove ineffective assistance, it would give defendants a better shot at getting their convictions reviewed, even with AEDPA still in place.
Right. It would force a much closer look at the legal representation that was provided. You might start to see more cases where, yeah, maybe a defendant's right to a fair trial was actually compromised.
It makes me think about those witness discrepancies we talked about earlier. You know, maybe if the standards for proving ineffective assistance were a bit stronger, Lambert's lawyer's handling of those conflicting statements would have gotten more scrutiny.
That's a perfect example of how this kind of reform could actually play out. It's about making sure that everyone, every defendant, has access to good legal representation. That's like the bedrock of a fair trial.
Are there any other reforms that are being considered? What else is on the table?
Another big one is all about expanding access to post-conviction evidence, especially DNA testing. The idea is that new evidence could clear someone who was wrongly convicted even if their appeals didn't go anywhere. We know that DNA evidence has been a game changer in so many cases, and proponents of this reform are saying, look, if we're restricting access to this kind of testing, are we actually keeping innocent people behind bars?
So it's about giving people a real chance to prove their innocence even years later if new information comes up. Mm-hmm. It seems pretty straightforward, right? The idea that seeking justice shouldn't have an expiration date.
That's the thinking, yeah. It's about recognizing that sometimes the truth takes a while to come out.
This whole deep dive into Lambert v. Blackwell has been really eye-opening. We started by trying to untangle this whole web of exhaustion and AEPA deference, and now we're talking about the potential downsides of those very safeguards. It's like we've come full circle.
It shows you how dynamic the law really is.
Yeah.
It's not just a set of rules carved in stone. It's constantly changing, evolving. And we have to keep questioning it, refining it, making sure it's actually doing what it's supposed to do, which is delivering justice.
And it's important to remember, this isn't just some theoretical debate happening in ivory towers. This is about real people's lives,
mm-hmm.
people like Lisa Michelle Lambert.
Yeah.
It really makes you think about whether we can ever truly strike that perfect balance between following the rules and making sure that justice is served.
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And honestly, there's no easy answer. But Lambert v. Blackwell is a stark reminder that we can't just sit back and assume the system is working perfectly.
Mm.
We have to keep pushing, keep asking tough questions, keep trying to make things better.
Couldn't have said it better myself. This deep dive has really shed light on some of the trickiest aspects of federal habeas corpus, and I hope our listeners are walking away with a better understanding of this whole issue.
I hope so, too, because at the end of the day, this isn't just about legal technicalities. It's about people. It's about their stories, their struggles, their fight for justice. And that's a conversation we should all be a part of.
Well said. A huge thanks to you for walking us through this legal maze. Your insights have been incredibly valuable.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And to our listeners, thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp and never be afraid to ask the hard questions.